Welcome everyone. So today I'll talk about building an open and managed Postgres service. I'm giving this talk because in my last few companies I specifically worked on different managed PostgreSQL services. Like currently I'm working at UbiCloud, which is an open source cloud where we build a Postgres service. And before that, I was part of the Microsoft Azure team who built PostgreSQL database for with CosmosDB APIs. And before that, I worked at Citus Data, which was acquired by Microsoft, and Citus Data was building a PostgreSQL extension that horizontally scales out PostgreSQL. And in that, I was also in the team building managed PostgreSQL service. So after building three managed PostgreSQL services, I thought it might be interesting to talk about how we build managed PostgreSQL services and what kind of problems we hit and how did we resolve them. And I also want to mention a little bit about UbiCloud, which is where I am currently working at. UbiCloud is an open source cloud. It's like AWS, but it is open source. So you can log into our web console and say that, hey, I want a virtual machine or I want a PostgreSQL database, and we provision and give it to you, and we also handle like the backups, high availability, everything. But the primary difference, it is open source. So if you want to host it yourself, you can just download all the code from our GitHub repository. And if you have some bare metal servers laying around, or if you want to, like you can also rent from one of the bare server providers, you can install it and basically you would have your own cloud. And specifically, today's topic is about like what it takes to build a managed PostgreSQL service. So I'm not sure if this is readable at the back rows, but basically this is a diagram of what you need to build. At the beginning, there is on-demand provisioning. Then there's like the DNS, certificates, backup and restore, internal API, UI, security. Then you have like the health checks, failover mechanism, high availability, firewall rules, extensions, like bunch of things. And each are interconnected with each other. So like for example, to have a highly available PostgreSQL database, you first need to have a monitoring. And then you also need to orchestrate failovers. And for example, to be able to have read replicas, first you need to have backups. So each connected with each other. And this is quite simplistic view of what you need, but this is like the main pieces. So if you want to have a managed PostgreSQL, basically you need all this. But of course, we don't have all the time in the world. So today I'll just focus on some of the more interesting ones. First of them is on-demand provisioning. Then we'll talk about backup and restore, high availability, and security. So let's start with the on-demand provisioning. Well, on-demand provisioning is quite easy. You don't need to do a lot of stuff. Basically, when your customer asks you to provision a database, what you would do, you first provision a virtual machine. Then you would just install the PostgreSQL binaries, and voila, like you, then you can give the connection string back to your user. But actually there are a few more steps. Like on top of installing PostgreSQL binaries, you usually also need to install PostgreSQL extensions, because PostgreSQL has very rich extension ecosystem, and most PostgreSQL users, they use PostgreSQL with the extension. So you also need to install at least like the most commonly used extensions, and which are kind of different for each people. So you have like, you need to install about 80, 90 different extensions so that each user can pick whatever they need. And the problem with installing extensions is that, well, some of the extensions are not packaged, so you need to compile them. And to be able to compile them, you also need to install the dependencies of the extensions. So overall, it takes a bit of time. But then like you can give connections back to customers. Except you also need to, like, if you want to secure database connections, you also need to have a certificate so that the user who connects to the PostgreSQL database, they can validate that they are connecting to the correct place. So you need to create a server certificate. The problem with the server certificate is that, well, someone needs to sign it. Usually you would want that certificate to be signed by someone who is trusted globally, like DigiCert. But that means you need to send an external request to DigiCert, which they, at some point, usually in minutes, but sometimes it can be hours, sign your certificate and return back to you, which is unfortunately not acceptable. So most of the time you would sign the certificate yourself. And for that, you first need to create a certificate authority, and then you can share the certificate authority with the users so that they can validate the whole certificate chain. And ideally, you would create different CA for each database so that the different users, they don't need to trust the certificate authorities of the other databases. Then, well, you also need to configure the PostgreSQL because, well, the customers might request different size of the databases, like the with bigger RAMs or more CPU, a bigger disk. And if you want PostgreSQL to run efficiently, then you need to configure some PostgreSQL settings so that the users can get the benefit of the whole hardware. And you need to do this for each instance type differently. And after this, now you can return connection string back to user. But you also need to create DNS records. This is what I mean. So currently our Postgres connection strings are like this. So there is a, like, the user password at, there's an IP address, which is the IP address of the virtual machine we just created, which doesn't look really nice. And it is very easy to forget, or like, it's not difficult to remember. Ideally, you would give users to something like this. So instead of an IP address, it would say like mypg.postgres.ubicloud.com or whatever domain you want to use. And the benefit of the DNS record is not just the representation, but in some cases, like for example, for high availability, when it is easy for users to talk with the same name, same connection string, even if the database server backing it fails over. And doing this is not that difficult. Usually you just add a record to your DNS server. You say that, hey, this is the name of the record, mypg.postgres.ubicloud.com, and this is type A record, so it points to a IPv4 address, and as a data, you would just put the IP address. And if for some reason, like for example, for failover or something else, if this IP address changes, you just need to change the data here. And hopefully, if you configure the TTLs correctly, in 5 seconds, all the clients would read this data to connect your domain name. So then this kind of, finally, there's no, I'll not add other steps to this list. There are few, but I'll exclude them. But now you can give the connection string to user and then they can happily use it. But the problem here is that we did lots of things and now provisioning takes a lot of time. It takes like more than 10 minutes with all the steps. And usually users want to have their database quickly. Like if you give them in 5 seconds, they would be very happy. They can accept few minutes, but 10 plus minutes is most of the time not acceptable, especially for the, you know, if you are claiming to build a new cloud, you need to be a bit quick. And there are few solutions you can do. One of them is you can create an operating system image with all the necessary binaries in it, so that you don't need to install and compile, and you don't need to deal with all that stuff at the time of the provisioning. So remember this long list. Instead of all these five items at top, we can replace them with single one, like the provision a virtual machine from operating system image. So as an independent step from all this, once you create an operating system image, you store that image to somewhere, wherever you want, and when a provisioning request comes, you just use that image. And when you do this, it significantly reduces the provisioning time. Like from 10 minutes, it reduces the like the 3-4 minutes, which is quite big win, but still not enough. So the next thing you can do is you can parallelize some of the remaining steps. So this is our remaining steps right now. So we provision the VM, create the server certificate, configure PostgreSQL settings, and return the connection string. Among these, none of the future steps actually depends on the creation of the certificate. So we can put that to a separate state, a separate step, and then we can do it on parallel. Then, after both rectangles are completed, then finally we can return the connection string back to user, which would give you a few more minutes. So now you can provision a database in approximately 2-2.5 minutes. And this is most of the time is good enough, but if you really want to notch it up, you can also create a pool of already provisioned databases, which is well, it is like what it is sound. So you create a bunch of databases, and you also configure them according to their instance sizes. And at the time of a provisioning request comes, you just need to configure the DNS record and then give the connection string to user. If you do this, then your provisioning times now becomes about 30 seconds or less. And this is what most of the public cloud providers do. So they do these three steps. Because even if you create a pool, sometimes your pool is empty, so you still need to do other steps. So you want other steps to be fast as well. So you also implement the other two optimizations, but you usually also keep a pool of already provisioned databases. And this is what I want to talk about, the on-demand provisioning. Next, I'll talk about backup and restore. But before going that, does anyone have any questions about what we talked so far? Okay, I saw one question there, right? Sure, like you can have one VM and have lots of databases in it, which would speed up some of the steps. But what we saw is that it is easy to escape from database to the operating system layer, which actually I'll also show how you do that in the security section. And in some cases, it is also possible to escape from one operating system user to another one, if there is some security vulnerability, which is like not very likely, but it's also not out of the picture. So you usually want to have separate virtual machines so that the different users have no way of accessing other people's data. Because as a database service provider, like that is the very strict requirement. Like, even if the database is down, that you can explain that, like, because that's life, that happens. But someone else accessing someone else's data, that's like, it's unacceptable. So because of that, most of the time you would want a separate virtual machine for separate users. Does anyone else have any question? Cool. Then I'll continue with the backup and restore. So for the backups and restores, the usual goal is being able to restore your database. But most of the time, they just restoring one day or 2 days ago is not just enough. You would want to restore your database to an exact minute in the past. So like you would want to say, hey, I want to restore my database 10th of March at 14:32. Because you have lots of things going on your database and lots of changes happening, not being able to restore the exact point, like little before, little after, your database might be in a state that you don't want. So usually you want to be able to restore to an exact date, exact, like at least any minute in the past. And to be able to do that, we need two things. One, well, we need base backups, which is like the full backup of the database. And we also need to record all incremental changes happening in your database so that you can restore to an exact point in time. So this is actually, this feature is called point in time restore, so that you can restore to any point in time. And base backups, this is quite easy because like we can take a full backup of the database whenever we want. It might be a bit slow because like we need to copy lots of data, or you might use, I don't know, file system backups, snapshots, like there are a bunch of ways to get a full backup of the database. Record of all incremental changes, normally this would be difficult because you need to have a way to record all the changes happening in your database. But thankfully, Postgres already does this for us. There's a concept called wall files. These files, their primary purpose is crash recovery. So basically, when you make a change in Postgres, Postgres doesn't put this new data to its next to actual data because it has a special format and modifying that file would take some time. But instead, it puts an append-only files called wall. And then if database crashes for some reason, it can look at those wall files and apply all the changes there to its main store. So at the time of the crash, you wouldn't lose any data. As I said, the primary benefit is, primary motivation is crash recovery, but as an extra benefit, they do what we want exactly. So they are record of the all incremental changes. So on top of getting base backups, if you also store all the wall files, then it gives you ability to restore any point in the past. And to do this, the process would look like something like this. For the backups, we would take full backups daily, once a day, for example. And then we would store all the wall files. And when someone wants to restore, we would use the most recent full backup that is before the target date. And from that target date, we would apply all the wall files one by one until we reach to the target time. So let's say if user wants to restore March 10, 14.32, we would create a database from March 10, 00, like at midnight, and then we would apply 14 hours long of wall files to reach the target date. This works well on paper, but it has a bunch of problems too. One of them is low activity. Let's say the user doesn't do lots of operations on the database. they might not generate one wall file per minute. So if they, wall files, they are, by default, they are 16 megabytes, and Postgres waits to fill up that 16 megabytes to switch to next wall file. And if your granularity is wall files, then what this means is, and if there's no wall file generated for 15 minutes, you cannot restore to a random point in that 15 minute time window. You can, your granularity would be like the 15 minutes. But to fix that, there is a config called archive timeout, which basically forces PostgreSQL to generate a new wall file every minute. So what PostgreSQL does is, if it hits 60 megabyte limit first, it creates a new wall file. If it doesn't, it creates a wall file when it hits 1 minute threshold. And with this, then now you have a separate wall file for each minute, then you can restore to any minute in the past. There is another problem, which is no activity. Here, Postgres behaves a bit differently. If there is no activity at all, so there is no write happened at a given minute, it doesn't create a wall file because of this archive timeout. So it doesn't, it ignores that value if there is no activity happening. That means, basically Postgres thinks that, hey, like there is nothing to do, and I don't need to create a wall file. And the fix is, you can make PostgreSQL do some small write activity. For example, there's a function called PG current transaction ID, which returns the current transaction ID. But if there is no transaction in progress, it assigns an ID, and which needs to be written in the wall log. So basically, you generate a very small write operation, which is, like, I think, the smallest you can do. If you run this function time to time, then you would be able to generate new wall files. And this is what I want to talk about, backup and restore. Now I'll continue with the high availability, but before that, does anyone have any questions about backup and restore? Cool. So for the high availability, it looks more or less like this. So you first need to provision a primary database. Then you would also provision a standby database. And then you start to monitor both primary and standby. So basically, you do some health checks every few seconds. And if you see a health failure, then you would trigger a failover. So the old standby becomes a new primary. And then, of course, now you don't have any standby left. So you need to provision another standby. In some cases, you might try to recover the old primary back and maybe add it back as a standby. But in practice, this doesn't work in all cases. And at least my personal opinion, instead of trying to do that in the cases it would work and doing to like the general solution in case it didn't, my preference is usually just getting rid of this primary because, well, compute is cheap. You can just create new virtual machines. I usually don't try to recover this primary unless it has some data that I need to have. But most of the time, especially if you are using synchronous replication, the standby already has all the data you need. The interesting part here is how would you do the health checks? Because you wouldn't want to trigger a failover at the first time you see an unhealthy signal. Instead, what you would do is you would try to do health checks a few more times. And after you see the unhealthy signals multiple times consecutively, then you would say that, hey, yes, this node is really down, then I can trigger the failover. And the naive way of doing this is you would just, for each server you have, you would have the status, like the healthy, healthy, then at one point it becomes unhealthy. And let's say after seeing 5 unhealthy signals, you trigger a failover. The problem with this approach is that to be able to make a failover decision, you need to look at all the historical records. Well, not all, last few historical records. And based on that, you need to make a decision. There is a simpler and I think better way to do this is keeping this data a little bit different. We still keep the healthy or unhealthy status, but we also keep a column for number of repetition for that state we saw. So if you translate this data to the next one, so at the first row, this is the first healthy signal, so the repeat is 0. Then when we see second healthy, the repeat is 1. And then when we see unhealthy, then this is the new state, so counter is reset back to 0. And then every time you see unhealthy, it is increased by 1, so it comes unhealthy 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the benefit of this is that at the time of the failover, you only need to read the last record. You just read the most recent record, and it tells you how many times it sees the unhealthy status. And also, updating this data is also quite easy because you can update it by just looking at the last one. Let's say you get a new signal says unhealthy as well. You just read the last record, and okay, the last record was also unhealthy, and this is unhealthy. The status was 4 at the previous record, then status repeat should be 5. So the updating is easy, reading is easy, and it gives you a few milliseconds at the time of the failover decision. And also it simplifies the whole failover decision mechanism, because there are few other metrics you want to look at, and checking all those metrics and also checking the historical data to make a failover decision might complicate the failure logic a bit. This simplifies it a lot. And with this one, we also have a few problems. Well, there are lots of pitfalls with high availability, but the one that I'll focus on today is the fencing the primary. So basically, when you decide that you need to do a failover, there are a few possibilities. Like one is maybe the primary is really down, then that's great. But in some cases, you might think that the primary is down, but actually it is not. Maybe the network between your control plane and the primary, there's a problem in the path. Or maybe the primary was really down, but after you do failover, for some reason it comes back online. Then the risk is some of the clients would connect to the new primary, and some other clients would connect to the old primary, and they would each write some data, and then, well, then you lose that data, at least lose one of it. So the fencing the primary is really important, and it is one of the steps that you have no, you have no wiggle room to make this wrong. So you really need to do this straight. And there are a few solutions. One is you can kill the Postgres process if the server is accessible. In some cases, you can access the VM but not the Postgres database. In that cases, if you want to trigger a failover, you can kill, like you can do sudo kill -9 or something like that to kill the Postgres process entirely. You can also, you know, if you are really paranoid, you can delete the Postgres binary so that it cannot come back. Another thing you can do is you can detach the network interface from virtual machine. so that no connection would arrive, like come or exit from the virtual machine. Or you can deprovision the virtual machine entirely. If you ask what do you do, well, we do all of it, because like sometimes the deprovisioning the VM is faster, and sometimes detaching the network interface is faster. If you can access the server, killing the Postgres process is definitely the fastest option. So we do all three in parallel, so that whichever completes first, then we can continue to next step of the failover. Because if none of these are completed and we continue to next step, then you have all these problems. There is also one non-solution, which is updating the DNS records. So you might think that, hey, like if I update the DNS records that I showed early to point my DNS record to point a new IP address, and then no one would connect to the old one, right? Well, unfortunately, they still, because, well, clients might, they do cache the IP address. And even if you have a low TTL, some of clients may or may not respect the TTL value, so they cache the value once and try to connect there all the time. So updating DNS record is not a solution. But as a part of the failover, if you want to keep your connection string same, you kind of need to update the DNS record anyway, so you would do this, but it's not because of the fan sync, it's because of increasing the user experience. And finally, I'll talk a bit about security. But does anyone have any questions so far? Yes?
Just a second, please. We need the audio for the billions of people on the internet.
Do you use any tooling to achieve high availability, or do you just use the basic Postgres functionalities, or how do you implement the high availability?
Yeah, actually there are many open source tools that does the monitoring and makes the failover decision and like orchestrates the whole failover. But we prefer to have our own. The reason is that as a managed Postgres service provider, you need to be able to have very precise modifications time to time. And you usually want to have full control. And since failover and high availability is one of the very key part of managing PostgreSQL database, we saw it as our core business. And we don't want to offload our core business to another tool. But that doesn't mean that we don't trust those. There are very good high availability. There are very good tools that orchestrate high availability.
Since we're talking about that and failover, I don't know your cloud enough, but do you have different regions where you fail over to another region? Because that of course, causes a lot of latency, and then I understand your point there.
Yeah. So in our current system, the primary we put the primary and standby to the same region, but to a different data centers. So the latency difference is not that big. We don't offer a high HA solution that has primary in one region and standby is at another. For that, what we saw is usually the read replicas work better, because for high availability, especially if you are using synchronous replication, then each write needs to go to standby and acknowledge, like return to standby first to be acknowledged to the back to user. But for read replicas, the most expectation from user is that the few minutes, like few seconds, and in some case, 1 minute of lag is okay. So for that one, not at UbiCloud, but in my previous company, some users prefer to have read replicas. and if something happens, they would promote their read replica. Does that answer your question? Cool. Okay. Any other questions? Cool. Then I'll also talk a bit about security. Well, did you know that with one simple trick, you can drop the OS level from your PSQL, and many PostgreSQL providers hate that. The trick is copy table from command. So there is a very useful utility in Postgres called copy, and it is usually used to copy data from one table to another, or copy data from CSV file to one of your table in or out. But it also has a option to run a command, something like this. You create one table. Is it readable? I'm not sure, but it says create table command results, and the type is text, and copy command text from program, and you just give the command in quotation marks, ls. And it says, okay, I copied 25 lines, and if you read back what is written in that file, in the table, it says PG version base, current log files, global, PG log, PG logical, basically the files in PostgreSQL own directory. And of course, this is like just ls command, but you can run all sorts of commands. And if the Postgres user is not isolated enough, you can read the files that you are not supposed to read. But before you go and start to hack your PostgreSQL providers, there are two caveats. One is, to be able to run this, you need a super user access. Like super user access on the database. So basically, you need to have a Postgres user or some other user that are given super user access privileges. And most managed services, they don't give you super user access. But not all. There are some managed Postgres services which give super user access. At UbiCloud, we give you super user access. I think Crunchbridge also gives you super user access. So this is caveat, but not really caveat, because it can be bypassed, as the managed services give you super user access. The actual caveat is that the command that you run, it is run as Postgres operating system user. And this is the place, as a managed service provider, that you can put necessary isolations. Because in Linux, there are lots of things that you can isolate users or processes. Like there are namespaces, there are file system permissions, like there are a bunch of things. So as a managed service provider, if you want to give Postgres super user access to your users, you really need to ensure that the Postgres user is isolated and can only access to the things that it should access. And to fix this, as I said, like you can limit the Postgres user's access, but even better, you would isolate each database at a different, as a separate virtual machine. So even if somehow Postgres user is able to escape from it is low privilege user to a higher privilege user, which happens, then they don't be able to read other people's data because they're in completely separate virtual machine. And even better, you can isolate each server's networks from each other. So if each of those virtual machines live in a separate network, then, well, even like they wouldn't be able to communicate the other virtual machines because there is none in their own network. And this is, there were few cases, for example, in the past, there were one managed service provider, they had, they used separate virtual machines, for their databases. But because of all the virtual machines were in the same shared network, and attacker was able to move from one virtual machine to the other virtual machine. It is public, but I'll not give any name. Anyway, so today, at the beginning, I show you this diagram. As I said, like there are lots of boxes, and they are prerequisite for each other. And we start with on-demand provisioning. We discussed on-demand provisioning, and we discussed DNS. We discussed certificates a bit. We discussed backup restore, health checks, failover, high availability, and security. And there are lots of other things as well that we couldn't cover. But and there are lots of other things that are not part of this slide as well. But if you were curious about how this managed Postgres services run and what they need to do to be able to offer those services, this was like a brief introduction to that. I hope it was interesting, and I hope it was useful. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Thank you, Burak. Do you have any questions?
Or do you have any questions left here?
Where's one?
There's one.
Yeah, right. I'm coming.
Here we go. Thank you for your presentation. I'm not a Postgres expert, but how will this setup change if you have more distributed environments, so Kubernetes and this stuff? Is there any change in it? Or is this practically exactly the same?
Well, most of it is same, because, and also I think it depends on the operator, like the Kubernetes operator. I know that some of the operators, they would also create virtual machines separately, and then they would basically do all this, but as a one, like Kubernetes operator. I saw in the wild there are some Kubernetes operators that create separate databases in the same virtual machine. I think that as a principles, it would look more or less same, but of course there would be some Kubernetes specific things. Like for example, I would guess you would also need to isolate on the pod level, because you can put pods to a different namespaces, and if the pods share the same namespace, I think it gives them some level access to the other pods in the same namespace. So I guess if you are using Kubernetes, you also need to take care of that. But in principle, you would still have the same problems, and you would still need to solve these problems. Does that answer your question, either? Cool.
How do you do this? Did you separate over the...
So you showed how you basically force the creation of an empty val file to have one there. Do you just do this to simplify your recovery process, or are there other advantages to this?
It doesn't have any other advantages. But what we do is we don't... You can do two things. One is you can have a cron job, for example, that runs this command every minute in case there is nothing happens, which might be okay, but you might see that as unnecessary load. Another thing you can do is that if there is at least one, let's say there is no activity for a while and no files generated, but then after a few minutes, there was some activity and a vol file was generated. If you tell Postgres, hey, I want to restore this time, it is able to do restore, because by looking at this final vol file, it can deduce that there were no activity here. So I can do all the things up to this vol file and then stop there. What it cannot do is that, let's say there's a wall file here, there's no activity here, and this is the current time, and user wants to restore here. So since this time there's no wall file, Postgres cannot restore here because it doesn't know that there is no activity between here and here. So what we do is we run that command just before, just after when user requests restore on the primary database, so that there can be another wall file after the target time. In this way, you don't need to run this command again and again. Does that answer your question? Cool. Okay. Are there any other questions?
Any more questions? Based on your algorithm, the question must come from the top right corner now, because I'm standing on the lower left. But there's nobody there. Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. That was awesome. Yeah. Small applause again.
Thanks all.